The expedition was successful, but Moore, to whom it had given an opportunity to see the eastern fortifications for the first time, found them formidable indeed and seriously doubted whether, with his existing resources, they could be overcome. Fortunately, the defenses to the west of the city were known to be a good deal weaker. On Kut, it seemed, the success of the operation might well depend. Kut was certainly showing himself dependable. By the evening of the 21st, after superhuman exertions by his men in pitiless heat, he had taken the Marabou Fort, on a small island commanding the further end of the long and shallow lagoon known as the Old Harbor, to the west of the city. At dawn on the 22nd, he began his advance along the isthmus, flanked by the navy in the Mediterranean on his left and the gunboats in the lake on his right. Nothing, it seemed, could stop him. The French forward positions dissolved at his approach. By 10 o'clock that morning, they had lost about 200 killed, wounded, and prisoners. British losses were 3 killed and 40 wounded. That afternoon, Healy Hutchinson himself sailed across the lake to confer with Kut and look at the western fortifications for himself. There was no doubt that those he saw before him were far weaker than those on the other side of the city. There and then he decided that the main force of the assault must be from the west. More and heavier guns were hastily embarked on the lake and carried across to Kut's camp. The moment they were in position, the artillery bombardment began, and with it the steady advance on the city. Rather than heading immediately for Alexandria, however, Kut's plan was to occupy a vantage point on the high ground just above Pompey's Pillar, to the southeast of the city, from which he could fire down on its defenses. This, however, proved unnecessary. At about 4:30 on the afternoon of the 26th, a French officer arrived at one of his advance posts with a request for an armistice. Kut immediately suspended the firing while the letter was taken to the commander-in-chief, and when a little after midnight he heard that Healy Hutchinson had agreed, he stood down his men. The fighting was over. True, there were moments in the next few days when it looked as if it might be resumed. General Mignot, having obtained his armistice, did his best to wriggle out of his obligations. First, he asked for a brief extension of the armistice period. Then he suggested a convention rather than a capitulation. Then he proposed a return of all the men of war and most of the artillery to France. Then the retention of all Egyptian public property in French hands. Finally, he even tried to have the armistice prolonged until 17 September, on the understanding that the French might then resume hostilities if their expected reinforcements had arrived. But Healy Hutchinson was having none of it. He simply sent Mignot his terms, repatriation for his army with personal arms and 10 pieces of artillery, all shipping and public property to remain in Egypt. If these terms were not immediately accepted, Alexandria would be blown to bits. Mignot gave in. There was no fight left in him, still less in his exhausted and demoralized men. A capitulation was signed, on what were still remarkably generous terms. At 11 a.m. on 2 September, the British took over Alexandria, while the band of the 54th assembled around Pompey's Pillar and played the national anthem. It was just at this triumphant moment that the force dispatched from India arrived at Rosetta after its long march from the Red Sea. Healy Hutchinson's men, who were half-starved and had lived in their clothes through appalling heat for the past 6 months, were incredulous when they saw it. It included whole regiments of cooks with exotic foods, wines, and spirits. Its tented camp looked more like the field of the cloth of gold. The sepoys, for their part, were shocked by the shabbiness of the British troops. No wonder that Healy Hutchinson thought it wiser to keep the two forces well apart. So the bulk of the British army sailed away, from the point of view of every single fighting man, not a moment too soon. In its determination to prevent any attempt by the French to return, however, the government in London ordered a surprisingly large garrison, 6,000 strong, to to remain at Alexandria at least until the peace, under the command of a reluctant and angry General Moore, who, despite his grave wound, still thirsted for action. A further 7,000 got no further than Malta, where a strong base was deemed essential. But Malta, where many of the men had left their wives, was a paradise after Egypt, and there were few complaints. The cost of the Egyptian expedition had been considerable, and not only in financial terms. It left behind 633 British killed or missing. About another 1,000 had died of wounds or disease. The wounded who lived to be repatriated numbered over 3,000, including 160 blinded by ophthalmia. Politically and strategically, on the other hand, the operation had been a triumphant success. In 6 months, British forces had achieved their objective, to show Napoleon that Egypt would never be his. In doing so, they had captured both Cairo and Alexandria, and throughout had shown quite astonishing steadiness and discipline, impressing their own officers almost as much as they impressed the French. They had also proved wrong the pessimists at home. A heartwarming story is told of how one day King George III had ridden out to the home of old Dundas in Wimbledon, where he had raised a glass of Madeira to the only begetter of the expedition. "When a person has been perfectly in the wrong," he declared, "the most just and honorable thing for him to do is to acknowledge it publicly." The British had been victorious. The French had been defeated. Quoi les amis, quoi possible de sortir d'une position? Critique avec une convention, sans se déshonorer, tout est perdu, wrote Napoleon. He spoke no more than the truth. But what, it may be asked, of the Egyptians themselves, who had probably suffered more from the 3 years of fighting than anyone else? Once the foreigners had gone, they were left in much the same situation as before, in theory, under the hopeless misrule of the Ottoman Empire, in fact, under the tyranny of the Mamluk Beys. But this situation did not last long. On 22 October 1801, all the principal beys were invited to a banquet on board the flagship of the Captain Pasha, admiral of the Ottoman fleet, which was lying at anchor off Alexandria. Most of them were mowed down by a Turkish gunboat before they had even reached the vessel. The remainder were imprisoned as soon as they arrived on board. Although a few survived, some had been in Constantinople, others had remained in Cairo, and struggled on for 2 or 3 more years, their power was broken. Nor could they continue to recruit their soldiers from the slave markets of the East, since in 1802 the Sublime Porte prohibited the exportation of young boys to Egypt. Unfortunately, however, the moribund Ottoman Empire was incapable of instituting an effective government in their place. Thus it was that virtually overnight, Egypt ceased to be a bone of contention and became a vacuum. Writing in 1803, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Wilson, who had kept a meticulous journal throughout the expedition and subsequently published a detailed history of it, expressed his astonishment that no adventurer endowed with fortitude, talents, and ambition had proposed to command a body of auxiliaries to act against the Mamelukes. While in the following year, a nameless American gentleman wrote from Cairo to Admiral Sir Alexander Ball, governor of Malta, that Egypt has no master. She must have a new master, and the first comer will be welcome. The first comer was not to be an Englishman nor a Frenchman, but a member of a race that has not until now merited a mention in this audiobook. He was, it is generally believed, an Albanian. His name was Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali was born in 1769 at Kavala in eastern Macedonia. After his father's death, he was brought up by the governor of the town. At 18, he married one of the governor's relations, who was to bear him 5 children. An assortment of other ladies was responsible for the other 90. The lucrative tobacco trade seems to have engaged him for some years. He then joined the Ottoman army, in which, having attained a relatively senior rank, he in due course found himself under the command of the Grand Vizier, fighting the French. For as long as the Europeans remained on Egyptian soil, he fought bravely enough, but after their departure, his Albanian regiment, commanded by a certain Tahir Pasha, and just about the only disciplined unit in the Turkish army, broke out in open mutiny. There is no reason to believe that Muhammad Ali had personally engineered the mutiny. Such risings of unpaid soldiery were frequent enough in Ottoman history. But after the murder of Tahir, he quickly assumed control, and by dint of various intrigues was appointed, in 1805, the Sultan's viceroy in Egypt. For the next 44 years, he ruled the land as a virtual dictator, eliminating the last vestiges of Mamluk rule, expropriating the property of the old landowning classes, and ruthlessly crushing successive insurrections. By 1815, nearly all agricultural land along the banks of the Nile and in the Delta had been nationalized, profits from agriculture going directly into his own coffers. He vastly improved the all-important irrigation system and introduced various new crops, notably cotton, which promised high returns. He also built up a fleet and a considerable army, conscripted from the peasantry but commanded by Turks and other foreigners. These he used at first on the Sultan's behalf, suppressing revolts in Arabia and in Greece. Later, in his own interests, he invaded the Sudan with similar success. He was to live until 1849, but for the moment, a far greater man once again claims our attention. Chapter 24. The Settlement of Europe. Napoleon Bonaparte had failed in Egypt. In Europe, on the other hand, he was going from strength to strength. In December 1804, in the presence of Pope Pius VII, he had laid the imperial crown on his own head in Paris. 5 months later, in May 1805, he had staged a second self-coronation. This time, his pettifogging little Italian republics, now forgotten, as King of Italy in Milan Cathedral. His decision to use for the ceremony the ancient iron crown of Lombardy, for centuries the property of the Holy Roman Empire, gave mortal offense to the Austrian Emperor, Francis, who thereupon joined the alliance formed by Britain and Russia a week or two before. Having thus consolidated his past conquests, Napoleon now embarked on a new campaign against Austria, and there was much rejoicing in the Grande Armée when on 20 October 1805 an Austrian army of 33,000 capitulated at Ulm. It was ironic that on the very day following, Nelson smashed a combined Franco-Spanish fleet at Trafalgar, he himself being mortally wounded at the moment of victory. But even such a disaster as this would not have remained long on the emperor's mind, since only 6 weeks later, on 2 December, his army of 68,000 triumphed over a combined force of 90,000 Austrians and Russians at Austerlitz in Moravia. On the day after Christmas, by the terms of a treaty signed at Pressburg, now Bratislava, Austria was obliged to return to France, inter alia, all the Venetian territories she had acquired in 1797 at Campo Formio, to constitute, with the coasts of Istria and Dalmatia, part of the new Napoleonic Kingdom of Italy. The emperor had refused to admit into the Treaty of Pressburg any stipulations on behalf of the Neapolitan Bourbons. Indeed, on the day the treaty was signed, he had declared his intention to hurl from the throne that criminal woman who has so shamelessly violated everything that is sacred among men. This verdict on Maria Carolina may seem a little harsh. It must, however, be admitted that his conclusion of a treaty of neutrality with Naples earlier in the year had not prevented her from appealing to her allies for assistance, and towards the end of November 1805, no fewer than 13,000 Russians, accompanied by 7,000 British troops from Malta, had disembarked in the Bay of Naples. They were joined by a few thousand Neapolitans, and by mid-December, the combined army had advanced to the papal frontier. But then there arrived the news of Austerlitz, and the whole expedition came to an abrupt and premature end. It had been a bad idea from the beginning, since in sending it, the queen had played straight into the emperor's hands. In his subsequent proclamation to his army, he was able to say, "Shall we trust again a court without loyalty, without honor, without sense? No, no. The dynasty of Naples has ceased to reign. Its existence is incompatible with the peace of Europe and the honor of my crown." The dynasty had not, of course, ceased to reign, nor would it finally do so for another half century, but it could not stand up to the French army of 40,000 men who now marched through the Papal States into South Italy under Marshal Massena, with Joseph Bonaparte as the emperor's personal representative. On 11 February 1806, the royal family fled, for the second time, to face the winter miseries of Palermo, and on the 14th, in drenching rain, a French division under General Partineau entered Naples. There was no resistance, whereas 7 years previously, the Lazzaroni had fought like tigers and caused appalling carnage. This time, they were listless and apathetic, making no protest when Joseph Bonaparte staged his own procession on the following day and took up his residence in the royal palace. Later that year, by imperial decree, Joseph was proclaimed king. "Naples captured, everything will fall," Napoleon had written to Joseph soon after the second flight of the royal family. Not for the first time, however, he had underestimated his enemy. Calabria proved a very much harder nut to crack. On 1 July 1806, a British force from Palermo under General Sir John Stuart, consisting of 4,800 infantry and 16 guns, disembarked on the west coast of Calabria. 3 days later, it attacked a French force near the village of Meda, and after a savage bayonet assault, routed it. The victory was welcomed with enthusiasm, not only locally, but also in England, where the battlefield is still remembered in the name of Meda Vale. Unfortunately, the fall, after a heroic resistance, of the city of Gaeta, together with Massena's decision to concentrate far greater forces against him, obliged Stuart to re-embark his troops in September. This meant that guerrilla warfare now took over, with the usual atrocities perpetrated on both sides. The Calabrians had no deep love for the Spanish Bourbons, but they vastly preferred them to the French invaders. Besides, had not the Pope refused to recognize Joseph Bonaparte as their king? They were of peasant stock, and when the fighting began, they pulled no punches. As for Sicily, an island ruled solely by King Ferdinand and Queen Maria Carolina, would probably have presented Messina with few problems. Nelson was dead, and the royal family had had a far cooler reception on their arrival than on their previous visit. The Sicilians by now knew their sovereigns all too well, and were fully conscious of the fact that the king saw their island as nothing more than a hunting reserve and an occasional funk hole. In the Palatine Chapel in Palermo, he had even destroyed a number of the superb 12th century mosaics simply to give himself more convenient access to the building. Moreover, all the principal administrative posts were taken over by Neapolitans, and many Sicilians, including in particular the younger sons of the nobility, found themselves unemployed. In such circumstances, a French invasion might have met with little enough resistance. But the true situation was very different. First of all, Ferdinand had invited the British to take over the defense of the island, which was just as well, as they would have done so anyway. And the Straits of Messina were now constantly patrolled by British gunboats. Secondly, the British had taken over a good deal more than Sicily's defense. In all but name, they were now masters of the island itself, with more than 17,000 soldiers and some 30 consuls or vice-consuls stationed there. Sicily also enjoyed a direct subsidy from Britain, to say nothing of a number of sizable loans and a good deal of private investment. The impact on the formerly sluggish Sicilian economy can well be imagined. British influence grew still greater after 1811, when the commander-in-chief in the Mediterranean, Lord William Cavendish Bentinck, was additionally appointed envoy to the court of the two Sicilies. Though Bentinck was still only 37, He had already served as governor of Madras and had subsequently fought in the Peninsular War. Able and energetic, he soon made himself effective governor of the island, embarking on a number of sweeping constitutional changes. In that same year, the king had arrested and deported five of his leading opponents in the Sicilian Assembly. By threatening to withdraw his army and suspend the subsidy, Bentinck now forced Ferdinand to reinstate them and to replace his largely Neapolitan ministry with a more liberal one, which actually included three of the deportees. In 1812, he introduced a liberal constitution on British lines, and soon afterwards he went still further. Queen Maria Carolina, who had rendered his task infinitely more difficult by thwarting him in every way she could, suddenly found herself exiled. No wonder she called him a wild animal, una bestia feroz. Though not permitted to perform the ceremony, Pope Pius VII had been invited to attend Napoleon's coronation in Paris, an invitation which, much as he might have wished to, he could not have refused. In the years immediately following, however, relations between Pope and Emperor grew worse and worse. Napoleon seized the all-important ports of Civitavecchia and Ustia, and by the beginning of 1808, by which time the Papal States were French in all but name, the imperial army entered Rome itself and occupied the Castle Sant'Angelo. Finally, on 17 May 1809, from the Castle Schönbrunn in Vienna, the emperor issued a decree announcing his annexation of Rome. Consummatum est, the pope is said to have murmured when he heard the news. On 10 June, the papal standard, which normally flew above the castle, was replaced by the tricolor, and the despoilers of the holy city were formally excommunicated. The pope was careful not to mention the emperor by name. Even so, it was a brave step for him to take, and retribution was not long in coming. On the night of 5 July, he was arrested and carried off by a strangely roundabout route that took him through Grenoble, Valence, and Nice to Savona. There he was to remain for 3 years until, while suffering a fever so severe that he received the last unction, he was transported, more dead than alive, in a locked carriage to Fontainebleau. Unlike his predecessor, who had died in his French exile, he was to return to Rome in May 1814. He lived on until 1823, by which time Christendom had assumed a complexion very different from that which he had known in the early years of his pontificate. In the autumn of 1807, when the Portuguese had refused to close their ports to British shipping, Napoleon had dispatched General Junot, whom we last met in Venice 10 years before, with an army of 30,000 men across Spain and into Portugal. The Portuguese royal family instantly fled to Brazil, leaving the French in possession of the country. Much of the invading army then moved into northern Spain. Meanwhile, Napoleon had sent his brother-in-law, the brilliant cavalry general Joachim Murat, to occupy Madrid and to bring the Spanish king Charles IV and his son Ferdinand to meet him at Bayonne. There, on 5 May 1808, they both abdicated their rights to the throne, Napoleon promising in exchange that Spain would remain Roman Catholic and independent under a ruler whom he would shortly name. Soon afterwards, he did so, and the name was that of his brother, Joseph. But Joseph's reign was doomed before it had even begun. On 2 May, the people of Madrid had risen against the invader. Joseph Bonaparte had started well enough in Naples. On his brother's orders, he had initiated a program of dismantling the vast feudal estates in the kingdom. He had reformed the monastic orders and done his best to regularize the financial, educational, and judicial systems. But he had never been happy there, and when Napoleon offered him the crown of Spain, he was only too happy to accept. The emperor replaced him in Naples with Joachim Murat. Murat indulged himself with an expensive, extravagant, and slightly ridiculous court, but he continued the work that Joseph had begun, carrying out a number of important social reforms, breaking up the vast landed estates and replacing the old, somewhat slap-happy laws of Naples with the Code Napoleon. He was to remain in Naples until his departure in 1812 on the Russian campaign, during which he once more distinguished himself by his bravery at Borodino. But having been left by Napoleon in charge of the shattered Grand Armée during the retreat, he in his turn abandoned it in an effort to save his Neapolitan kingdom. When the news of the emperor's escape from Elba reached Italy, Murat, back in Naples, was one of the first to declare for him, immediately putting himself at the head of an Italian army. But on 3 May 1815, in defiance of the emperor's instructions, he was foolish enough to challenge a large Austrian contingent and was soundly beaten at Tolentino. He sought refuge in Corsica and, in October, made a last attempt to recover Naples. But by then, the Neapolitans had enough. They took him prisoner and shot him. The Madrid Rising was quickly and brutally suppressed, but other provincial insurrections sprang up all over Spain, whose people, as always, showed their superb capacity for guerrilla warfare. The French were driven back from Valencia, and General Pierre Dupont, who had advanced into Andalusia, was ultimately forced to surrender with his entire army at Bayalin on 23 July. The rebels now advanced on Madrid and expelled Joseph a few weeks later. By this time, the British had joined the fray, British forces under Arthur Wellesley, the future Duke of Wellington, having landed in Portugal on 1 August. It was largely thanks to them that the massive French counterattack the following winter failed to crush the revolt altogether. The Peninsular War was to continue until 1814, through Portugal and northwestern Spain, but although Spain is a Mediterranean country, the war was in no sense a Mediterranean war, nor was Napoleon Bonaparte directly involved in it. His history, after his departure from Egypt in 1799, has not indeed greatly concerned us. He had moved his theater of operations back to northern and central Europe, where it was to remain for the next 15 years. During most of those years, his star continued to rise, but in 1812 came the disastrous Russian campaign, after which little went right for him. The Allies were now drawing the net even closer, and in October 1813, the Emperor's defeat at Leipzig sealed his fate. There was one more last hopeless campaign, but on 30 March 1814, Marshal Marmont was obliged to surrender Paris to the Allies. Less than a fortnight later, Napoleon formally announced his abdication, and soon afterwards began his period of exile on the island of Elba. Elba had had a checkered history. In antiquity, it was known principally for its iron ore, which was mined first by the Etruscans and then by the Romans. During the early Middle Ages, it was subject to Pisa, but in 1290 it passed to Genoa, and in 1399 to the Dukes of Piombino, who ceded it in 1548 to Cosimo de Medici of Florence. Since then, it had been ruled by Spain and later by Naples. Only in 1802 was it ceded to France. On the arrival of Napoleon, it became an independent principality, with himself as its ruler. He landed on 4 May 1814, and the whole island was instantly galvanized. "I have never seen a man," wrote the British commissioner, Sir Neil Campbell, "in any situation in life with so much activity and restless perseverance." Napoleon took Elba seriously, seeing the island not as a prison, but as a state to be governed. He set its population of some 112,000 to work building new roads and bridges, even establishing a miniature court, with the strict etiquette on which he always insisted, and hoisting over his palace at Porto Ferrario a new standard, emblazoned with his imperial bees. His mother and his sister, Pauline, arrived in July. Soon, too, there arrived his Polish mistress, Maria Walewska, and their little son. So far as he was concerned, there was only one absentee, his second wife, Marie-Louise, the eldest daughter of the Austrian Emperor Francis I, whom he genuinely loved, desperately missed, and for whom he had carefully prepared the country palace of San Martino. But her parents were determined to keep her in Vienna. He was never to see her again. Meanwhile, he watched and waited. There were plenty of encouraging signs. Most of his army remained loyal. In Paris, the arch-reactionary, Louis XVIII, was making himself more and more unpopular. The Congress of Vienna had reached a deadlock. In Elba, on the other hand, his finances were dwindling, and his mother was constantly encouraging him to fulfill his destiny. And so in February 1815, Napoleon made up his mind. The day after Campbell had left on a visit to Italy, he ordered his only ship, the brig En Constant, to be made ready. On the 26th, he sailed, landing on 1 March without opposition at Golfe-Juan between Fréjus and Antibes. The most straightforward route to Paris would have been up the Rhone Valley, but Provence was frantically royalist and had greeted him with hostile demonstrations on his way south the previous year. Besides, it was obviously the route that would be taken by any royalist army sent to oppose him. He therefore chose instead the mountain road that leads through Digne, Sisteron, and Grenoble, known ever since as the Route Napoléon. That road, which took the emperor back to Paris and, after the 100 days, to Waterloo, takes him also out of our story. Only then could the Bourbons return to Naples. Queen Maria Carolina, however, was not among them, effectively abandoned by her miserable husband, who at the time of her deportation by Bentinck had not lifted a finger to help her. She had returned to her native Austria. It was there in the castle of Hertzendorf, just outside Vienna, that her dead body was found on the morning of 8 September 1814. She had been a woman of spirit, even of courage, but she was consistently wrong-headed, and it was very largely to her that the Bourbon kingdom of Naples owed its decline and its eventual collapse. Little more than a week before Waterloo on 9 June 1815, the Congress of Vienna held its last session. It had opened the previous September, 5 months after Napoleon's abdication, and had suffered an awkward moment when the news arrived of his escape from Elba. But it had continued to sit, casting all the time a wary eye to the West, and its final settlement was to prove the most comprehensive treaty that Europe had ever seen. Tsar Alexander I was there in person to defend the interests of Russia. The Austrian Emperor Francis II was represented by his first minister, Prince von Metternich, the King of Prussia by Prince von Hardenberg, and King George III of England by Lord Castlereagh. The later admission of Bourbon France to the Congress brought to Vienna the most brilliant of them all, Prince Talleyrand. Spain, Portugal, and Sweden were also represented, and the number were supplemented by countless European noblemen and their ladies, all come to enjoy the most brilliant social season that the continent had to offer. The majority of the decisions reached in Vienna affected the northern states of Europe and need not detain us. Where the Mediterranean was concerned, Venice, together with Lombardy and the Veneto, found herself once more in Austrian hands. Genoa was absorbed into Piedmont. Tuscany and Modena went to an Austrian archduke, while Parma was given to another Austrian. The Empress Marie Louise, she who had been ill-advised enough to marry Napoleon just 5 years before. The Papal States, which in 1798-99 had formed part of the Cisalpine and Roman Republics, and in 1808-09 of the Kingdom of Italy, were generously restored to the Pope. There remained a certain amount of tidying up to be done, notably with the 7 Ionian islands off the west coast of Greece. The respective histories of these islands vary to some degree, but the basic pattern remains very much the same. First Byzantine, then Norman Sicilian, conquered by Robert Guiscard, then Venetian after the Fourth Crusade, then Turkish, except Corfu and Paxos, which remained Venetian till 1797. After Napoleon's occupation of Venice in that year, one of his first actions was to send 2,000 men to the islands, possession of which he believed to be essential to his Eastern and, in particular, to his Egyptian plans. By August, they were all in French hands, and 2 months later, the French rule was legalized at Campo Formio. As in Venice, the golden books of the local nobilities were systematically burned, the lions of St. Mark chiseled off the gateways. But the French soon made themselves hated, first by their anti-clericalism, and then by their insistence on granting the Jews equal status with the Orthodox Christians. So it was that when Russia and Turkey joined the Second Coalition against Napoleon in 1798, and, taking advantage of the French defeat at the Battle of the Nile, dispatched a joint fleet under Admiral Fyodor Ushakov to recover the islands, the Orthodox Russians, if not the Turks, were greeted as liberators. Only on Corfu did the French have a big enough garrison to put up a fight, but after several months of siege, that too was forced to surrender. Under the terms of a Russo-Turkish convention of May 1800, the islands now became an independent federal republic, under the protection of the Tsar and paying annual tribute to the Sublime Porte. When war was resumed between Britain and France in 1803, it seemed at first as if their independence would be respected. But Napoleon still remained obsessed by Corfu, and by an annex to the Treaty of Tilsit, signed with the Tsar on a raft in the middle of the River Niemen on July 1807, the islands were transferred from Russian to French protection. A year later came a further setback to British amour propre when the French captured Capri. The commander-in-chief, Mediterranean Lord Collingwood, having heard from a number of Cephalonian and Xantiot merchants that the islanders were eager to regain their independence, decided to retaliate by taking as many of the Ionian islands as he could. The considerable force that sailed from Sicily in 1809 easily recovered Cephalonia and Zante, Ithaca and Cythera, but Corfu was too strongly defended for direct assault. The only alternative was a blockade, which in fact proved little better than a farce. It was maintained by only two small frigates, and as soon as these were out of sight, the French boats would run out across the straits to Albania and return with all the food they needed. Thus, for the next 6 years, the military representatives of the two powers, at daggers drawn in Europe, pursued similar peaceful policies on islands often within sight of each other. Neither side found the islanders easy to govern. Blood feuds were part of the normal way of life. Murder was an everyday occurrence. Ignorance and superstition were everywhere. An English traveler reported that when the governor of Cephalonia attempted to introduce the potato to the island, some of the priests labored to convince the peasants that this was the very apple with which the serpent seduced Adam and Eve in paradise. Gradually, however, they were won over, and by March 1811, a Major Richard Church had succeeded in raising on Zante what he called the 1st Regiment, Duke of York's Greek Light Infantry. A 2nd Regiment, raised on Cephalonia and officered almost entirely by Greeks, took part in the capture of Paxos in February 1814. Though both regiments were disbanded at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, many of their Greek officers and men were later to turn their experience to good use as leaders in the Greek War of Independence, notably the great Theodor Kolokotronis, nearly all of whose portraits and statues show him inseparable from his British helmet. In November 1815, it was jointly agreed by the plenipotentiaries of Britain, Prussia, Russia, and Austria that the Ionian Islands should henceforward be an independent state under British protection and governed by a British High Commissioner. A month later, there arrived to take up this post the then Governor of Malta, Sir Thomas Maitland. Sir Charles Napier, who served under him, describes him as a rough old despot, insufferably rude and abrupt, particularly dirty in his person, and constantly drunk and surrounded by sycophants. Despite these feelings, however, and a Scottish accent that rendered him almost incomprehensible to Corfiots and compatriots alike, King Tom was to rule the islands for the next 10 years with a firm and surprisingly enlightened hand. Meanwhile, across the straits on the Albanian mainland, a far more portentous drama was beginning to unfold. It was unleashed because of the ambitions of the nominal Turkish governor in the city of Yanina, a certain Ali Pasha. When Byron visited him in 1809, he wrote, "His Highness is 60 years old, very fat and not tall, but with a fine face, light blue eyes, and a white beard. His manner is very kind, and at the same time, he possesses that dignity which I find universal among the Turks. He has the appearance of anything but his real character, for he is a remorseless tyrant, guilty of the most horrible cruelties, very brave and so good a general that they call him Mohammedan Bonaparte." Ali had started life as a brigand, which is essentially what he remained. In his youth, he and his followers had instituted something like a reign of terror in Albania and Epirus. The Ottoman authorities had done their best to crush him, but time and again he had outwitted or outfought them, until at last, in despair, they had decided to bribe him with high imperial office. He had become governor of Yanina as early as 1787, and from this power base he and his family had extended their authority over virtually all Greece and Albania, apart from Attica and Athens itself. He had also transformed his capital. Yanina had always been beautiful, set in a spectacular setting of lake and mountains. He improved its roads, instituted 2 trade fairs a year, built caravanseries for the merchants, and even dug a ship canal. His sumptuous palace contained the largest Gobelins tapestry ever made, which had previously hung at Versailles. The changing fortunes of the Ionian Islands were always of interest to Ali, and sometimes of concern. During the years of Venetian rule, Venice had also controlled the 4 chief coastal towns on the mainland opposite Butrint, now Albania, directly across the strait from Corfu, Prevesa, and Bonitsa, flanking the entrance to the Gulf of Arta, and Parga opposite Paxos. When in 1807 the islands became French, Ali had seized the first 3 before anyone could stop him, but the Russians, who maintained a strong garrison at Parga, had handed it over to France as agreed. The local population, who had no love for the French, at first had little option but to put up with them as best they could, but when the Napoleonic star began to sink, they hoisted the Union Jack and appealed to the British to support them. Thus it was that on 22 March 1814, a small British military force took possession of the town. All now should have been well. Unfortunately, when in the following year the Congress of Vienna made the Ionian Islands a British protectorate, the mainland towns were specifically excluded and passed instead to the Turks, with the proviso that any inhabitant of Parga who wished to cross to the islands should be allowed to do so. Had the Congress left it at that, most of the Pargiots would probably have remained where they were, but it went further, stipulating that all immigrants should be compensated by the Ottoman government for the mainland property that they had abandoned. As a result, every single citizen chose to leave, and the Turks, faced with huge compensation payments, offered Parga to Ali. The amount of compensation was finally fixed at £150,000, which in due course Ali paid, and on Good Friday, 1819, some 3,000 Pargiots, with their icons, their holy relics, and in some cases even the bones of their ancestors, crossed the straits to Corfu, where the money was divided among them. They were, we are told, inconsolable, and their story was to become one of the great legends of Greek suffering under Turkish rule. The point is less often made that they left their homes voluntarily and were compensated for them, and that by remaining in Parga, they would have fared no worse than the populations of the neighboring towns, who were all denied chances of leaving. Ali Pasha did not live long to enjoy his new acquisition. An attempt in February 1820 to assassinate one of his relations, a certain Ismail Pasha, who had incurred his displeasure and fled to Constantinople, was traced back to him and gave Sultan Mahmud II the opportunity he had been seeking. He thereupon appointed Ismail governor of Yanina in Ali's place, gave him a small army, and ordered him to do the rest. That same autumn, with Ismail's troops closing in, Ali set fire to the city and retreated to his citadel, which stood on a promontory projecting into the lake and was additionally protected by a broad moat. Here he seemed likely to hold out indefinitely, but in January 1821, with a stalemate still persisting, Mahmud dismissed Ismail and replaced him with the infinitely more capable Khurshid Pasha, governor of the Morea. Khurshid, seeing that nothing could be expected of Ismail's motley army, which consisted of a number of separate forces, each going its own way under the command of its own pasha, spent the next year putting it into shape. Then, at the beginning of 1822, he smashed his way into the citadel. There were various stories about how Ali met his end. A few days later, his severed head was exhibited on a pike in Yanina, before being borne back in triumph to Constantinople. Chapter 25. Freedom for Greece. The beginning of the Greek struggle for independence from Turkish rule can be dated to September 1814, when three young Greeks in Odessa founded a secret society. To avoid suspicion, they called it by the deliberately non-committal name of Philiki Eteria, the Friendly Association. None of the three had so far acquired any distinction. Nikolaos Skoufos was a hatter. Emmanuel Xanthos was a bankrupt dealer in olive oil. Athanasios Sokolov had no settled occupation. They got off to a slow start. Although they had all three been born in Greece, as expatriates, they were unable to tap into the resources of the mainland. While even among the Greek diaspora around the Black Sea, they were too insignificant to be taken seriously by the rich merchants whose support they needed. Little by little, however, the association's numbers increased. Its founders moved their base to Constantinople, where in those days there were almost as many Greeks as Turks, and whence they sent emissaries into Greece itself. One to Macedonia and Thessaly, one to the Peloponnese and the wealthy islands of Hydra and Spetsai, and two to the Mani, the central of the three promontories of the southern Peloponnese. The Mani had been the focus of an earlier unsuccessful uprising, instigated in 1770 by Catherine the Great, through her lover, Count Grigori Orlov. As a somewhat paradoxical result of this incident, the Ottoman authorities had removed it from the jurisdiction of the governor of the Peloponnese and subjected it directly to the Captain Pasha, head of the Turkish armed forces and overlord of the Aegean, and he, in his turn, had devolved his power to the head of one of the local families with the title of bey. The eighth of these beys, appointed in 1815, was to be one of the heroes of the Greek Revolution, of whose family no fewer than 49 were to fall in battle during the coming struggle. His name was Petrobey Marvomichalis. Petrobey was, like all his family, outstandingly handsome, only to be expected, perhaps, his ancestor George having reputedly married a mermaid. This quality he combined with graciousness of manner, high intelligence, and, as he was later to show, indomitable courage. Like any tribal leader, he was capable of cruelty when he believed it to be justified. But he was also generous and, in his own territory, a man of peace, settling blood feuds wherever he could and doing his utmost to create the solidarity which he knew would be necessary in the years ahead. When approached by the association, he instantly gave it his support. Before there could be any question of taking up arms, however, the movement had to find a leader. The most distinguished Greek living at that time, and the obvious first choice, was Ioannis Kapodistrias, more usually known outside Greece as Kapodistria. Born in Corfu, he came from an ancient family which had emigrated to the Ionian Islands from Italy in the 14th century. In his youth, he had been active in local political life, so impressing the occupying Russians that he had been invited to join the administration in St. Petersburg. In normal circumstances, his status as a civil servant of the Russian Empire might not have prevented his accepting the presidency of the association. Unfortunately, however, in 1815, Tsar Alexander had appointed him joint foreign minister, so that when, in 1820, Emmanuel Xanthos requested an audience and extended the invitation, he was turned down flat. The association's eye next fell on a dashing imperial aide-de-camp named Alexander Ipsilatus, who, though still in his 20s, had already lost his right arm in the service of the Tsar. Two of his brothers were already members, and he accepted without hesitation. There was still a long way to go. Total membership numbered only 1,000 or so. But Ipsilatus was impatient, and on 8 October 1820, issued a proclamation calling upon all Greeks to prepare themselves for the struggle ahead. The revolution, he declared, must be unleashed in the Peloponnese before the end of the year. Characteristically, he had failed to consult his contacts on the spot, who were now obliged to inform him that the Peloponnese was not yet ready. He therefore decided to begin in the north rather than the south, in the Danubian principalities of Moldavia and Wallachia. It was in many ways a surprising choice. Neither of these regions, both of them lying in present-day Romania, formed part of Greece, nor technically were they part of the Ottoman Empire. Their legal status was that of vassal states, into which the Sultan was forbidden by treaty to send troops without Russian consent. This meant that the Tsar, in the interests of his Orthodox co-religionist, might be persuaded to prevent Turkish forces from opposing the insurgents. An additional advantage was that for the past century, the two regions had been governed by Greeks from Constantinople, who could be expected to give whatever support they could. Encouraged by such considerations, on 6 March 1821, Ipsilatus, with two of his younger brothers and a few companions, crossed the border into Moldavia. That same evening they entered the capital, Iași, where another proclamation was issued, promising, with very little effort, to annihilate the Turks completely, while a mighty empire defends our rights. There was, in fact, every indication that the mighty empire would do no such thing, both Cappadocia and the Tsar himself having made it clear to Ipsilatus that they disapproved of the whole project and would have nothing whatever to do with it. And from that moment on, the campaign, if so it could be called, was an unmitigated disaster. In Galatz, a town some 100 miles south of Iași, the rebels massacred the Turkish garrison and all the Turkish merchants, and when the news reached Iași, the Turkish guard there of some 50 men, who had already disarmed on the promise that their lives and property would be spared, was also put to the sword. Moreover, when Ipsilatus realized that the funds which he had confidently expected in Iași were not forthcoming, he had resorted to extortion from rich bankers. Meanwhile, the unpaid troops that he had assembled were looting the local villages. Now, seriously alarmed, Ipsilatus marched on Bucharest, only to find that a local adventurer, Teodor Vladimirescu, had got there before him and occupied the city, summoning the local Wallachians to rise up, not against the Turks, but against the Phanariot Greeks, dragons that swallow us alive. But the two greatest blows were yet to fall. First, the Orthodox Patriarch of Constantinople, supported by 22 bishops, sentenced Ipsilatus and the other leading rebels to be excommunicated and cursed and not forgiven and anathematized after death, and to suffer for all eternity. Then the rising was formally denounced by the Tsar himself. In a statement drafted by Cappadocia, Ipsilatus was cashiered from the army on the grounds that he had abandoned all the precepts of religion and morality. He and his colleagues would receive absolutely no support from Russia, to which he was forbidden ever to return. Fortunately, Vladimirescu was soon captured and taken to Ipsilatus's camp, where he was quickly dispatched. Their numbers swelled by Vladimirescu's disaffected followers. The rebels then decided to tackle the Turks head-on, and on 19 June, they encountered a considerable Ottoman force in the village of Dragashan. In the ensuing battle, half of them were cut to pieces. The other half fled. Ypsilantis escaped into Austria, but was arrested as he crossed the border. He was imprisoned at Mohacs until 1827 and died the following year. In Greek popular legend, he is usually seen as a hero and a martyr, and so in a way he was. But he possessed neither the intelligence nor the experience required to lead a successful rebellion, and it was due as much to his sheer incompetence as to anything else that the first campaign of the Greek War of Independence ended in fiasco. In the Peloponnese, the prospects for the coming revolt looked somewhat brighter, particularly after the departure in January 1821 of Khurshid Pasha, governor of the Morea, to deal with Ali Pasha of Yanina. Khurshid had been a considerable force in the region, and his replacement by a young and ineffectual deputy led to an immediate slackening of Turkish authority. Only days later, there arrived from Zante the boisterous, black-mustachioed, 50-year-old ex-brigand who was, more than anyone else, to personify the Greek War of Independence, Theodore Kolokotronis. With his commanding presence, his resounding laughter, and his terrifying rages, he was a born leader of men. Within days of his arrival, he had impressed his personality on all around him. The fuse had already been laid, but it was Kolokotronis who lit the match, fixing the day of the rising as 25 March. Even then, a few communities jumped the gun. In the little town of Areopolis, a plaque in the square of St. Michael's Church reads, "From this historic square was launched the Great Uprising, under the leadership of Petrobey, 17 March, 1821. To Mavro Michalis, therefore, belongs the honor of being first in the field. But Kolokotronis was not far behind, marshaling on the 20th some 2,000 armed men who marched through Kalamata amid cheering crowds. 3 days later, they accepted the surrender of the Turkish garrison, having promised them that their lives would be spared. Alas, they were not. As a contemporary writer put it, the moon devoured them. In little more than a week, the entire Peloponnese was in revolt. Not everywhere, however, did the rebels have it all their own way. In Patras, the chief city and port, the rising in the last days of March met with serious opposition, the Turks barricading themselves in the citadel and firing their cannon down on the besiegers below. And within a few days, there was further disappointment. Bishop Germanos, who not only held the See of Patras, but was also the leading churchman and figurehead of the whole revolution, had appealed to all the Christian powers for support, and on 29 March received a reply from Sir Thomas Maitland in Corfu. "Ionian subjects," wrote Maitland, "were forbidden to involve themselves in the struggle on either side. Were they to do so, they would instantly lose their government's protection." Then on Palm Sunday, 3 March, a Turkish force of 700 men reached Patras under the command of a certain Yusuf Pasha. Yusuf had recently left the siege of Yanina to take up a new appointment as governor of Euboea, calling en route at Missolonghi, now Messolongion. He had heard of the disturbances and had hurried at once to the city's relief. He and his men entered Patras at dawn, surprising the Greek population in their beds. Most of them rose, panic-stricken, and fled for their lives, while Yusuf ordered the houses of all the leading citizens to be burned to the ground. With a strong scirocco blowing to fan the flames, some 700 buildings were destroyed. Meanwhile, the streets filled with rampaging Turks, all of them out for Greek blood. Of those Greeks who had stayed behind, 40 were beheaded in the next few hours. Patras was to remain a battleground until the end of the war, with Greeks and Turks alternately getting the upper hand, but never so decisively as to bring the fighting to an end. Despite constant battering from the Greek guns, the Turks never lost control of the citadel, nor were they ever driven from the two other great castles of Rumeli and the Morea, which face each other across the Gulf of Corinth, at the point where the straits are at their narrowest. Without this invaluable bridgehead, for the Greeks were firmly ensconced at Corinth, the vast peninsula would have been impenetrable to them from the north, their seat of government at Tripolis, dangerously isolated. With it, they were able to make life for the rebels difficult indeed. There was no doubt now that the Peloponnese was to be the heartland of the struggle. It was there that Kolokotronis, now officially Archestrategos, commander-in-chief, won his first pitched battle at Valtezzi, only 5 miles from the seat of the Turkish government at Tripolis. The Turks lost some 700 killed or wounded, the Greeks perhaps 150. It was there, too, that the Greeks captured from the Turks their first great stronghold, Monemvasia, in the southeast corner, whose immense outcrop of rock many had thought impregnable. In Rumeli, on the other hand, which is to say all Greece to the north of the Gulf of Corinth, the occasional outbreaks of fighting were largely directed towards